Welcome to the ASHP Official Podcast, your guide to issues related to medication use, public health, and the profession of pharmacy.
Thank you for joining us for the ASHP Advocating for Impact podcast, where every episode covers a policy issue impacting the practice of pharmacy. We'll do our best to translate the policy and the politics to help you understand how these issues affect your practice and your profession. I'm Tom Krause. I'll be your host for today's episode. Today, I'm joined by Kyle Robb, ASHP's Director of State Policy Advocacy.
Oh, thanks for having me.
In this episode, we'll discuss implications of a recent federal court ruling regarding 340B contract pharmacies. At issue is this 2021 Arkansas law that prohibited drug makers from placing restrictions or limitations on 340B contract pharmacies. The court decision to uphold that Arkansas law is a significant boost to our ongoing efforts in multiple states to pass ASHP and 340B Health's model state contract pharmacy legislation known as the 340B Contract Pharmacy Protection Act. And there's similar legislation being considered in other states. So let's dive into that a little bit more as we go. But Kyle, can you just get us started with some background? What motivated this Arkansas law and why were lawmakers seeking to protect contract pharmacy?
Sure, absolutely. So I guess let's start. Let's go way back all the way to the beginning and start with the 340B program. So the 340B program was established by Congress in the early 1990s. And really the purpose of this program is to give safety net providers access to discounted drugs. So basically the program requires drug manufacturers to provide certain safety net providers. So, you know, healthcare facilities that serve underserved populations and uninsured populations, require drug makers to provide drugs to these specific entities known as covered entities at discounted prices. The 340B program is effectively a tax on drug manufacturers that's payable directly to safety net providers, with the purpose being that that funding is intended to cover the cost of providing uncompensated care to underserved populations. And, you know, a larger driver of those costs is the high cost of pharmaceuticals, hence the purpose of the program. So it was started in 1990. And along the way, the original 340B program statute, the law that Congress passed to create the program, did not say anything about contractual arrangements between covered entities and outside pharmacies or outside other providers. So over the course of the evolution of the 340B program, in the early 2010s, I think around 2010, somewhere in that area, HRSA, the Health Resources and Services Administration, the government agency that's responsible for overseeing the 340B program, they began registering contract pharmacies. So they sort of formally created an application process and allowed 340B qualifying hospitals and other providers to enter into contractual arrangements with pharmacies to dispense 340B drugs for them. So how does a contract pharmacy arrangement work? Basically, the 340B covered entity purchases on behalf of the contracted pharmacy and arrange shipment to the contracted pharmacy for them to receive the 340B drug and then provide it to the patient. So the contracted pharmacy is not itself a 340B covered entity. However, a 340B covered entity collaborates with that contract pharmacy to allow 340B discounted drugs to be provided to patients via that pharmacy, via arrangement between the covered entity and that pharmacy. Both covered entities and pharmaceutical manufacturers will both agree that contract pharmacies have been increasing in size over the last decade. We've seen the number of contract pharmacy arrangements continue to increase over the past decade. And both sides would also agree that an increase in the number of contract pharmacies enables more prescriptions to be purchased at the 340B discounted price. So obviously here we see a misalignment of incentives between the two players, right? Safety net providers obviously have incentive to further and deepen their contract pharmacy arrangements to maximize the amount of 340B benefit they're getting from their patients. And pharmaceutical manufacturers have been incentivized to try to limit the proliferation of contract pharmacy arrangements so they can limit that increased spending that they're seeing in the program, or the increased number of drugs that are qualifying for 340B via contract pharmacies. Okay, so how did that dispute come to a head?
Before we even get there. So just so folks are following. So these covered entities are, they're eligible for the 340B program, and they're eligible to dispense drugs to their patients at that 340B price, such that the covered entity can benefit from that 340B discount. What's happening is these contract pharmacies are dispensing that drug on behalf of the contract pharmacy. And so when we talk about these limitations that are being imposed by manufacturers, I just want folks to understand that it's a restriction that's being imposed for a patient that is legitimately a patient of that contract, of that covered entity, and the covered entity is absolutely qualified. So there's it is true that the program has grown, but it is also true that these patients are legitimate patients of that contract pharmacy and of the covered entity, and the covered entity is entitled to discounts. And HRSA has throughout the program said that is okay for covered entities to use contract pharmacy. Is that right?
Correct. At no point has HRSA at any point throughout this dispute said that contract pharmacy arrangements are not permissible, or at any point indicated that manufacturers are not required to provide the same level of discounts via contract pharmacy.
So now we get into these restrictions, and the restrictions are not imposed by HRSA. They're not imposed by Congress. These are restrictions that manufacturers are sort of unilaterally attempting to impose to restrict growth of the program.
Correct, yes. So these so-called contract pharmacy restrictions, we first saw them pop up back in the summer of 2020. We had some announcements we saw from AstraZeneca and Eli Lilly were among the first manufacturers to announce these policies. But they basically just made an announcement back in mid-2020 saying, hey, you know, effective so-and-so date, we're going to have some changes to how we do contract pharmacy arrangements. And in the time since 2020, several more manufacturers have followed on. There's several websites out there that track manufacturer policies vis-a-vis contract pharmacies. And at last count, there were 31 manufacturers that have imposed some kind of restriction since 2020. Okay, so how do these restrictions work? How are they manifest? How do they actually get implemented by the manufacturer? So the way that we most commonly see these restrictions come into play, and I will also mention, you know, not every manufacturer has imposed these restrictions. A lot of manufacturers have not implemented any contract pharmacy restrictions. However, several have. But among the few that have, there's also variations between their policies. But we can, you know, give you some broad general aspects that we see kind of frequently. And that really is, you know, capping the number of contract pharmacies. So either saying we're not going to sell 340B drugs to contract pharmacies at all, or saying you only get one, you have to pick it. So limiting or prohibiting entirely contract pharmacies is one aspect. Similarly with child sites. So, you know, we're not even talking about contract pharmacy arrangements. We're talking about health system affiliated or owned pharmacies that are outside of the primary covered entity site or off campus in the primary covered entity site. So seeing limitations on those as well, in addition to contract pharmacies, limiting the number of those that can be used. And another common component that we're seeing here is really the agitation for claims data and claims collection. So various policies might require participation in an online claims information platform, the most commonly cited among which is 340B ESP. So this is sort of a situation in which the covered entity must register with this sort of third-party claims reporting platform, and then agree to submit a certain level of data. After that, that claims data is received by the clearinghouse and the manufacturer. At that point, the manufacturer then provides a 340B discount. So in that sort of situation, they're kind of transforming the 340B program from a discount program, which the purchasers purchase at a discount, to a rebate program by withholding some of these benefits until after they receive in-kind information.
And so in the statute that creates the 340B program, is there any requirement that covered entities turn over data to manufacturers in order to qualify for discounted drugs?
There's not. There's no such requirement in the 340B statutes. Yes.
Sort of a leading question, but I just want to make sure that listeners understand that these are not required by the program. These are requirements that are being imposed by the manufacturers. And HRSA has actually kind of pushed back on the ability of manufacturers to impose these sort of extra statutory requirements. The problem is, HRSA really does not have teeth to enforce that, and frankly, this probably was not contemplated by Congress when it drafted the legislation in a way that would prevent HRSA from pushing back effectively. So that leads us in this situation where there are different parties to the program, the covered entities, HRSA, and the manufacturers kind of with different views about the whether these restrictions should be imposed. So now policymakers are starting to figure out, well, how do we correct this? And so what are the options being considered?
Right. So as you correctly pointed out, since day one, HRSA has told manufacturers that these contract pharmacy restrictions are not permissible and has told them to stop doing it. However, the manufacturers and HRSA have engaged in various lawsuits and other litigations. And basically, the courts have decided that, you know, HRSA's claims that these actions are unlawful carry weight. However, HRSA has no ability to actually meaningfully punish these manufacturers in the way that would actually prevent them from doing the things that HRSA says is unlawful. So basically, we're at a regulatory stalemate. More or less, the manufacturers under the current regulatory framework can get away with this. And you know, the case law behind us makes it seem unlikely that sort of new regulatory authority is going to be discovered that wasn't previously known, absent any additional law getting passed. Okay, so we've established that HRSA is not going to regulate its way out of this problem. So we need a law passed. Who could pass a law? Well, obviously, Congress could pass a law clearing all this up, giving HRSA enforcement authority, making it clear that this type of activity is not allowed in the program. We do have a bill to do that. It's called H.R. 7635. It's called the 340B Patients Act. And it was introduced by Representative Doris Matsui from California in March of 2024. However, this dispute has been ongoing since 2020, and this is the first bill we've had introduced. So we're very thankful to Representative Matsui for introducing this bill, and the ASHP absolutely endorses the Protect the 340B Patients Act, and we encourage its passage. However, you know, the 4 years in between this program, this issue propping up, and the first bill being introduced in Congress is a big indicator that Congress does not really seem to be urgent to resolve this issue and legislate this issue. So if Congress can't write legislation, and legislation is necessary, well, then where else would we go to address this issue? And there's one other option that has popped up and is seeming like a more and more viable pathway, and that is the option to pass state laws to prevent these contract pharmacy restrictions.
And so enter Arkansas and the law that they created going back 4 years now. So what was the intent of that law? How did it restrict manufacturer activities? And what are we seeing from other states?
Yes. So Arkansas Act 1103 was the first of its kind. This is the first state law that we know of that attempted to make it a violation of state law for a manufacturer or a wholesaler or distributor to restrict access to 340B drugs at a contract pharmacy. It establishes any such restrictions as a violation of state law and a finable offense by the Department of Insurance.
And so, obviously, the pharma industry has been pushing back on HRSA's ability to enforce in this area. No doubt, they're going to push back on opportunities for states to regulate in this area as well. So, what is pharma's argument as to why that Arkansas Act 1103 and similar laws should be invalidated?
So pharma immediately sued as soon as Act 1103 was passed, and they had two primary arguments for why 1103 should be tossed out and invalidated. Their first argument was that this represents an unlawful restriction on interstate commerce. These drugs are obviously often manufactured out of state, shipped from out of state, so you know the state can't put these restrictions on how we're shipping stuff. Without getting too far into the weeds, there was a Supreme Court decision in 2023 called National Pork Producers Council versus Ross that had to do with a pork law that was passed in California. That's basically the argument that pharma was relying on was the same as the argument in this case. Supreme Court ruled against the pork producers in this case, and that severely undermined pharma's argument around interstate commerce.
It's not intuitive to me why a pork law is relevant. So what's the sort of short version of what they were trying to say?
Yeah, judicial precedent is a funny thing. California passed a law a couple of years ago that said if you want to sell bacon or pork products in California, then the pork has to be produced in accordance with the laws and regulations that govern farming in California. So pork producers outside of California sued this, you know, basically saying, look, we comply with the laws of the state where the farm is located. California can't make additional regulations in other states. But the Supreme Court sided with California and said, actually, yes, California can put those conditions on pork sales in the state. So again, not very intuitive, but the sort of underlying precedent there severely undermined pharma's interstate commerce arguments on this.
So it comes down to the state can regulate activity kind of within the state, even if it's in the context of these sort of broader national programs.
Right, exactly. So commerce argument is gone. That leaves them with one other primary argument they were making. And basically that boils down to, you know, 340B is a federal program. The federal government really ought to be the ones making the rules and conditions on this. You know, states adding on additional layers of rules and regulations to this program isn't appropriate and shouldn't be allowable because it will make it impossible for people to, for manufacturers to operate nationwide to comply with the program. So that was really their primary argument, that this is a federal program and these types of law are basically improper tampering in a federal program.
So that was Pharma's argument. So what was the argument on the state side, the Arkansas side, and why did the court rule with the state of Arkansas?
So Arkansas's argument, which the courts agreed with ultimately, was that this law does not inhibit their ability to comply with 340B. It actually promotes their ability to comply with 340B by making it very clear the state's expectations for compliance in areas where the federal statute is currently lacking in detail. So they are the state is stepping in to provide the detail that is currently lacking, currently unclear, and creating these disputes. Additionally, you know, the courts noted that it's clearly accepted precedent the states have the ability to license and regulate manufacturers, wholesalers, and pharmaceutical distributors. All 50 states already do that. States also have the clear ability and precedent to regulate the practice of pharmacy, which includes the distribution and dispensing of drugs. So taken all together, it's clear that this is the state's wheelhouse, and it was not the opinion of the courts in any way undermined the 340B program or made it more difficult for pharmaceutical manufacturers to comply with it.
Yeah, so states are already doing a ton of regulation of kind of the relevant entities and the products, and so it just it's not sort of beyond their grasp to regulate in this area. So okay, so the courts have ruled against pharma and upheld that that Arkansas law. So is that the end of the road for this litigation? Or is there anything that we can expect pharma might do to push back on that decision?
Sure. So, you know, the initial ruling in this case was in a district court that was appealed up to the federal appeals court. So this decision we're talking about today was from the Eighth Circuit Federal Appeals Court from a 3-judge panel. So pharma lost the initial case. They lost this appeals case 3-0. All judges on the panel side with Arkansas. So from here, pharma can appeal this case further to the entire panel of the Eighth Circuit, or they could petition the Supreme Court to take up an appeal. It seems unlikely, given the outcome of the previous two cases, that the full panel would reverse. It also seems unlikely that the Supreme Court would reverse or even agree to take the case. So from that perspective, it seems unlikely that this particular decision is going to be reversed. You know, that being said, pharma and individual drug makers do have additional active litigation against other state laws in this area. Louisiana has a similar state law. And there's sort of other you know, areas that are sort of probing around this. So while this decision is definitely a major victory for Arkansas and state efforts to regulate 340B, you know, there continues to be some unanswered questions around the fringes of these of this particular arena.
Yeah, and we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that drug manufacturers and pharma as an association have an enormous amount of resources and capabilities to pursue litigation, and so you know, we'll have to see what happens next. But okay, so for the time being, we are where we are. The court has ruled in favor of the state of Arkansas. So what does that mean as a practical matter for regulation of contract pharmacy in the state of Arkansas and in other states?
It's made it extremely clear, basically, that the state of Arkansas has free rein to enforce this law. They can impose fines as authorized by the law against pharmaceutical manufacturers, and pharmaceutical manufacturers have a much clearer obligation to comply with the law. You know, again, prior to this decision, the state of Arkansas has already fined Novo Nordisk $100,000 for violating this law, and that case is currently in court, and I'm sure this decision will impact the outcome of that. But, you know, in Arkansas, it means basically they're going to be able to begin enforcing the law. You know, when they passed these laws, and as this court case was pending, 6 out of the 31 manufacturers actually did lift all of their contract pharmacy restrictions in Arkansas. So, you know, that's progress, but also that means 25 didn't. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, the state of Arkansas is going to, you know, ensure that those additional manufacturers start complying with the law. But also just, you know, to give you an example of some further existing lack of clarity in the law, you know, we talked about 340B ESP and claims data. Well, the Arkansas law doesn't explicitly say that 340B ESP particularly is per se illegal. So during this dispute with Novo Nordisk, where Novo Nordisk was not offering discount drugs to contract pharmacies, during this litigation, Novo Nordisk actually offered as a compromise to covered entities in Arkansas, hey, if you sign up for 340B ESP and you give us all your claims data, then we'll remove all of these restrictions. And, you know, Novo Nordisk is still, even after this ruling, maintaining that it is perfectly legal under the Arkansas law for them to condition these 340B discounts on the submission of claims data. Now, regulators in Arkansas might disagree with that. However, it's not extremely clear in the existing language in Arkansas that that, you know, is not allowed. It's clear that that manufacturers have to, you know, make efforts to allow contract pharmacies to acquire these drugs, but whether or not they can put some of these conditions, like this claims data condition, on some of these discount arrangements is still probably going to be challenged by manufacturers, even mm-hmm. in states that have these laws like this.
Mm-hmm. So I understand that manufacturers may continue to kind of impose restrictions, but also states are kind of moving in a direction similar to what we've seen in Arkansas, similar to what we've seen in Louisiana. I think there are something like 20 states that are considering legislation. And at the beginning of the discussion, we mentioned that ASHP and 340B Health have some model legislation that they've that we've worked on together, that states can use to advance solutions in their state. So can you tell us a little bit about those resources and any other resources that folks interested in protecting the 340B program in their state can turn to?
Sure. Yeah. So just to back up a little bit, you know, we said Arkansas was the first state to pass this bill in 2021. The states largely took a wait and see approach to how this was going to work on Arkansas' side. So we've seen limited legislative activity in the last two sessions. As I mentioned, we had a second state pass a similar bill that prohibited contract pharmacy restrictions in Louisiana in 2023. Those are the only two states that have actually passed a law to date. However, in the 2024 session, as people are sort of seeing the Arkansas and Louisiana laws stand up to some of these legal challenges, that has created some momentum here. So you're correct, Tom. We're tracking introduced legislation in 20 different states in the 2024 session. And we have bills that have passed the legislature in two states, in Virginia and West Virginia, and we're waiting on the governor's action for that. And we expect several more states to follow in the 2024 session and even rolling into the 2025 session, because, you know, this court ruling came down at a time in which a lot of legislative sessions have actually already wrapped up. So certain states won't be able to sort of take this information as precedent and act on it until next year. However, when those states are ready, we are providing them with resources. So as you mentioned, Tom, ASHP, in coordination with 340B Health, we developed model legislation that we call the 340B Contract Pharmacy Protection Act. And basically, it just takes all of the best elements of these different state laws and puts them all together for stakeholders who are looking to pass a contract pharmacy bill. Basically, it just establishes, as we said before, that any sort of restrictions, limitations on contract pharmacy arrangements for child sites by manufacturers is an unlawful violation of state law and a finable offense. We clarify that they can't put any additional conditions or attempt to withhold discounts based on additional conditions that are above and beyond the 340B program. That's meant to, it's a nod or a reference to some of these claims information collecting schemes that we're seeing from some of these manufacturers. And as well, it contains clauses about severability and federal preemption, just to head off any potential challenges that we've seen on technical grounds and very narrow technical grounds we've seen sort of in other states. But, you know, this is really just meant to be, you know, another sort of resource for our state affiliates, for pharmacist members to be able to access, to be able to provide to stakeholders that are looking to do something about this in their state.
And we should mention that this is in addition to another law that we created for states that is around restricting the ability of insurers to discriminate against 340B covered entities. So there's two pieces of legislation that would be helpful to protect the 340B program at the state level. And for listeners, if you're interested, feel free to go on ASHP's website, just search for 340B in our advocacy webpage, and you'll see links to a lot of this content. And Kyle, I understand for folks who are going to be at the Pharmacy Futures meeting this summer, you're going to be hosting a session around this. Can you just mention some of what folks might expect if they join that?
Indeed, yeah. Anybody who will be in attendance at Pharmacy Futures 2024 in Portland, Oregon this June, we will be hosting a session. Myself, Jeff Little, and Daniel Rackman, we will be hosting a session on 340B advocacy around this. So we will be doing a sort of long-form discussion of how state laws can address the 340B program, the 340B contract pharmacy issues, as well as sort of give some accounts of sort of how the advocacy efforts played out in different states. But really, I think a main takeaway that I want people to take away from this particular CE session that we're going to do in Oregon is, you know, we're going to provide examples of how contract pharmacy arrangements, how health systems utilize contract pharmacy arrangements to really extend care to their patients and to really maximize the benefits of the 340B program to really expand their patient care offerings. Because I think, you know, in so much of this debate, that's really the most powerful advocacy tool for people to be able to talk about the importance of the 340B program and really draw a direct line between that and patients' access to care and patient outcomes. So we're going to be talking about the current status of these laws, what's going on in other states, and as well as some advocacy efforts from individual health systems and in their states trying to get these individual laws changed. So anybody who's interested in the 340B contract pharmacy issues or state advocacy around 340B, we definitely encourage them to attend that session.
Great. Thank you so much, Kyle. And I just want to mention that those resources that we have created, they are not restricted to 340 or to ASHP members. Please, if you are in an institution, particularly if it's a 340B covered entity, share this information with your leadership. Share it with the government relations team at your institution. Let them know that there are solutions available that they could advocate for in their state. Similarly, hospital associations or even patient organizations that you might be part of or have relationships with, please share this, because I think there's a potential coalition of supporters that extends well beyond pharmacy for a lot of these issues. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Kyle. Obviously, this was a much more detailed conversation getting into the litigation and some technical issues than you would normally encounter on this ASHP podcast channel. But we think it's important. It has a lot of impact on the ability of safety net providers to benefit from the 340B program and for their patients to access services, including pharmacy services that are supported by the 340B program. So thank you again, Kyle. Please visit ashp.org to learn more about our advocacy issues, including grassroots efforts and ways that you can get involved in ASHP's advocacy efforts. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to ASHP Official, the voice of pharmacists advancing healthcare. Be sure to visit ashp.org/podcast to discover more great episodes, access show notes, and download the episode transcript. If you loved the episode and want to hear more, be sure to subscribe, rate, or leave a review. Join us next time.